last time round, we, after going through Rashi, moved on to the Balei HaTosfos and talked about them. What I wanted to do this time was Rabbeinu Tam. Even just a little bit of Rabbeinu Tam is very important. And then we had decided we would switch over to the Sephardi side of this era in history and go back in time to the Rif. Clear? Good? Okay. So Rabbeinu Tam, first of all, I think I said last time, his name was not Tam, right? His name was Yaakov. He was born in the year 1100 in Ramaru, northern France. Tam is a nickname that was given to him because Yaakov Ish Tam Yoshev Ohalim. So that's the association. He was grandson of Rashi, we said. He was the son of Rabbi Meir ben Shmuel, who married Rashi's daughter Yocheved. He was much younger than his older brothers. His oldest brother was the Rashbam, Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir, who we talked about last time. There's 15 years in between them. There's also the Ri in between them. There are stories about...
The Ri Magash?
No, Ri Magash is on the Sephardi side. The Ri is Rabbeinu Yitzchak. I think we mentioned him on our list last time.
He was on that list.
He was on that list. Yeah. Where is he?
What do you mean that
the... Not the Ri. The Rivam is his older brother. Rashbam and then the Rivam are his older brothers.
Oh, so you just mean they were 15 years apart.
Yeah, 15 years, or 15 to 20, because I saw some were 20, so I'm not sure why I wrote 15 here.
Same mother?
Same mother, yeah. There are stories about Rabbeinu Tam actually learning with Rashi, but historians doubt it just based on where they lived and
their age.
When Rashi passed away. If he's born in 1100, I think we said Rashi passed away in 1105. So it's a little awkward. Possible. If you're Rabbeinu Tam, anything
is
possible.
Right. Who knows what he knew at 5.
Right. He becomes wealthy in business. He's in the wine trade as well as money lending. He has issues with the government because anybody who was anybody had issues with the government back in the day. Actually, I just read this morning. I'd forgotten, but the OU, the OU sends out a Halacha Yomis email. It's very good. So they sent out an email about tomorrow being Chav Sivan. Chav Sivan for centuries was a fast day in Europe for a couple of major events, one from the beginning of Khmelnytsky massacres in 1648-1649, but one goes all the way back to the times of the Balei HaTosfos. And Rabbeinu Tam, I think, was the driving force of creating this fast. Or not creating the fast. The fast becomes official only after the 1648-1649 event. But Rabbeinu Tam was active and involved at the time after that, the first event that took place. He was personally attacked on Shavuos in the Second Crusade in the year 1146, and he left Ramru for Troyes at the time, Troyes being where Rashi's Beis Medrash was. He passes away in 1171. So Rabbeinu Tam writes poetry, interestingly. His tshuvos actually begin, some of his tshuvos begin with brief poems, which is something that I'm used to seeing among the Sephardim. I was not familiar with that at all in Ashkenaz, but you can find it, it's available, you can see it. But his writings that he's known for are certainly primarily Gemara and Halacha. That's really where he's known, and he is the backbone of the Balei HaTosfos. We talked about last time, I think, the approach of the Balei HaTosfos, how they wanted to harmonize different passages in the Gemara, to, not like what Rashi is doing, which is very local, on the spot, explaining what's going on here, but saying, well, how could you say this here? What about what it says over there? Viewing Shas as an integrated whole that is responsible to each other, even though it's true that, yes, Rabbi so-and-so may disagree with Rabbi so-and-so, and where this says, this is Beis Hillel talking, and here it's Beis Shammai talking, so we're not surprised that there's a disagreement. But where Rabbi Yossi says one thing here, and Rabbi Yossi says something there, now we have a problem. I just did that yesterday. I'm giving Daf Yomi on Shabbos, so there's a whole discussion about an issue called Brera, which we're not going to go into now. It's a labyrinthine discussion, but the Gemara brings you three Tanaim, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, and Rabbi Shimon, and it goes through Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon and their positions here and their positions elsewhere. It doesn't go through Rabbi Yossi. And Tosfos says, well, wait, what about Rabbi Yossi? Mm-hmm. Rabbi Yossi said such and such. Elsewhere, how do we reconcile? And comes up with different approaches, as Tosfos does. If you take a look at source number one, I brought you this from Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, the son of Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, the Tosafist movement. He says, the greatness of Rabbeinu Tam did not lie in his discovery of dialectic. He didn't invent the idea that when you look at an issue, there are two sides that are sort of in tension with each other and each pulling in different ways that lead to the result. That's the dialectic concept. That's not his. That is systematically employed in most discussions of the Talmud. Like, the Gemara does that all the time. But rather, in the scope and depth of his use of it, Rabbeinu Tam's influence extended over the entire Talmudic corpus. He scarcely treated a topic that he did not revolutionize by dialectic. He was able to offer many hundreds, probably thousands, of legal distinctions that subsequent thinkers found and to this day still find essential for any understanding of Talmudic law. So fecund were his ideas, and so productive was his mode of thinking that this type of analysis has continued to the present day. In brief, Rabbeinu Tam rewrote halachic thought by his revival and use of dialectic and made this method an indispensable tool of Talmudic study. I mean, just to explain by example a little bit of what this is, not from Rabbeinu Tam, but I remember this conversation I had with somebody many, many years ago. I was a kid in summer camp, and I had a counselor who decided he was going to teach me how to learn Iyun, how to learn something with analysis. And he gave me an example. Yeah. It was in Marasha. I don't know. I have this memory of it. I don't remember who the counselor was. I wish I could remember who the counselor was. But he mentioned the classic debate between Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. When you light the menorah, do you go up or do you go down? And the Gemara has a discussion about why each one says what it does. On the one hand, Malin Bakodesh Vein Moridin. On the other hand, modeled on the bulls that they bring as Karbanos on Sukkos, where they go down from the higher number to the lower number. The Gemara has exploration. So he tried to show me that it's based on how you understand what you are doing when you light the menorah. There are different ways to understand what's going on when you light menorah, and this taps into this, and this taps into that, and that leads to these different ways of looking at it. So if I could remember what he actually said, I mean, I was, I don't know, max 13. I would tell you, like, how this actually played out. But that idea that you could look at a mitzvah and say, well, the mitzvah could be read this way or could be read that way, and both impulses are there in it, and they lead to how we do things halachically. That's this dialectic concept that we're talking about, which Rabbeinu Tam develops, and he does it all over Shas.
He brings you from the argument from the halacha back to the original source? Is that what you're saying?
So he's giving you insight into the idea behind the halacha. It may, often does, tap into the Gemara, and he'll show you, look, this is visible in the Gemara here, this is visible over there. He's not going back to Psukim as a general rule. But it gives you a much stronger understanding of what the sugya is all about. There's a style of shir in yeshiva in which they'll find one point, one type of distinction like this, and then they'll give you a dozen different ways in which that plays out in halacha. If you say this way, then this is the halacha, and if you say this way, then this is the halacha. And your whole shir is built on this one nekuda, this one point that then has...
like a tree.
Yeah. That's a classic way that that shir works in learning Gemara. That's really, you know, his impact, and it leads to impact on every aspect of Jewish life. He dealt with issues when communities were in flux because people were moving because of all of the persecution and because of different economic opportunity in different places. He dealt with issues of government within a community. Just one example in source number two from the Chasam Sofer, who is, of course, much later, end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century. The Chasam Sofer is talking about a person who violates a community standard. And he says the community is not able to punish a person who violates the standard unless the standard was adopted unanimously. So the Chasam Sofer writes, and I'll just read out my English translation, "The practice in all of our exiles is that we follow the majority for all such matters. When you want to create a standard, you follow the majority. If we were to wait for unanimity, no affair would be concluded and the community would be damaged. It appears to me that for the same reason, even Rabbeinu Tam, who rules that the community cannot take punitive action to protect the community standard unless there was unanimous agreement to the standard at the outset, rules that way only as far as the letter of the law. He would agree that as a matter of common practice, the majority may force an individual to do as they say." He says, letter of the law, it should require unanimity, but in practice, even Rabbeinu Tam would agree not. And my point in bringing this is only to show you that the Chasam Sofer needs to deal with the position of Rabbeinu Tam with the things that he's going to do. Rabbeinu Tam is this overarching figure many centuries later. He dealt a lot with minhag issues. And here I had to bring this, because how could you not? Somebody wrote to Rabbeinu Tam regarding a community practice they had for writing a name in a get. And their practice was different from what Rabbeinu Tam considered to be the community norm. Rabbeinu Tam said, this is the way that we do it. And this person who writes to Rabbeinu Tam wants them to do it differently. So if you take a look at source number three, if you take a look at source number three, he says the following. Gam kasapta she'en l'shanos ha-minog mibnei halaz. You, this person is writing to him, you said that we should keep on doing it the way we do it here, because otherwise people are going to say that whatever it was that we did in the past was no good. Right? Rabbeinu Tam says...
So that all those marriages were bad?
Oh, divorces. These are getting...
Oh, sorry.
But any marriages that followed the divorces.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're going to cause people to question the gittin if you're going to tell me that we should do things differently. This is our minhag. And Rabbeinu Tam says famous words. Minhag ze gehenom lemafreya. Right? The letters, if you reverse minhag, you get gehenom. She'im shotim nahagu chachamim lo nahagu. He says, even if fools did that, sages never did it. And then he goes on. I didn't bring my full translation. I'm not sure why. Vafilu minhag hagun eino oker halacha elam kein rofefes. He says, even a good minhag will not uproot halacha unless the halacha itself is uncertain. Then you look at whatever the minhag is. Ubazeta isa toz gedola val tosif ledamos dimionos ka'ela. He says, you have made a big mistake and, you know, quit with your comparisons that you're making.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Is this the general consensus with regards to minhag today?
Like, no, because minhag is not gehenim today. I'm like, what?
Well, he's saying
no,
that it can be.
He's saying it could. He's not saying
it can be. In this case, it is. Right. I mean,
made a statement saying that all minhag.
Right. I think that what I ended up doing on this source sheet last time round, I only brought this for Rabbeinu Tam because we had so much else to do before then, and I knew I wasn't going to get very far. So I didn't bring the rest of the sources that I referred to in my notes here, and the result of that is that you're missing what would have been the next source, which is a piece from Sefer Hayashar, in which he specifically defends a minhag. Mm-hmm. It has to do with bracha on Shabbos candles, saying our minhagim are Torah because they come from the poskim of Eretz Yisrael. So when he doesn't like a minhag, he says, yeah, that's osios gehenim. When he likes the minhag,
Sefer
then he
Hayashar
says,
minhag is Torah.
So Sefer Hayashar is Rabbeinu Tam. It's a collection of his chuvos in part and his chidushim in another part.
I mean, that's like such a contradiction. It's kind of...
But it's not. He's saying where the minhag is right, then honor it. Where the minhag is wrong, get rid of it.
Uh-huh. So meaning, like, in the hierarchy of things, like, halacha comes before minhag, basically.
Yeah. Yes, halacha overpowers minhag. It's only
nothing
aware
new. That's what I'm saying. So it's nothing new. What he's being very, like, sharp about it.
First of all, he is very sharp. He's absolutely very sharp. But you also have to recognize minhag is huge in this era when all these communities are moving and people are being uprooted and coming to a new place and saying, but I did this.
Well, that's our lives now. Everyone came from Europe with very different minhagim, and you have like tons of different minhagim going on.
And for the same reasons.
I always wonder about that when they all came and they would have to leave them and have
well, even now, did you all keep
not get in fights the whole day?
They did.
They yeah. Did. No, but they did. It was the issue.
They married, like my grandparents, would never have a mixed marriage. Right. My grandfather was from Brits. My grandmother was from a Hasidic dynasty. Yeah. Like, he had no beard. It was like unheard of, but.
Right, but everyone married.
Yeah.
It's just
like, what were they
combined? All the time.
So that's what he was fighting. He was fighting people's tendency to like grab onto him and hug him over halacha.
Correct. Correct. As he saw it. But as he saw it was what mattered, because he was Rabbeinu Tam.
Well, because in those days there wasn't like a Mishnah Brura, right? Like there wasn't like a
correct
sense of halacha that was clear.
Certainly not not the way that we are familiar with. Yeah. I mean you had certain you had the Rif, who we're going to talk about, but you didn't have anything that was as clear-cut and as exhaustive as the literature we have today. I mean, that's one of the reasons we get that. Every time you have one of these upheavals, you end up with basically a new code of Jewish law, if you will. So this is followed by the Rif, the Rambam, right, the Rush, eventually. And then when the Jews are kicked out of Spain, right, they leave Portugal, that whole upheaval, you get the Shulchan Aruch. I mean, the tour really is from this, is the outgrowth of this, because this leads to the Rush, which leads to the tour. But the Shulchan Aruch right. is, you know, is what you get when you have this also turmoil of communities all arriving in different places and being in conflict. Jews, after that whole Iberian Peninsula empties out, go to the Ottoman Empire, they go to Morocco, they go to Poland, and...
Yeah, so they take get, with them know. The Shulchan Aruch.
Yeah. Well, the Shulchan Aruch is written after that. The Shulchan Aruch is written in the middle of the 16th century.
Right.
It's a response to what they're dealing with.
Okay.
And then you see it in, you know, modern times with the, you know, this, well, not just that, but this flow of halachic literature, you know, where we have a sefer, you know, Pidyon HaBen Kehilchasa. You know, who needed a Pidyon HaBen Kehilchasa over the years? You knew. You had a community. You knew what Pidyon HaBen was, and that was the way you did it. And you know, you didn't need someone to tell you how many sugar packets or whatever it was. But you get to a point where there's such an upheaval and such a loss of connection that, you know, there's a need for this. I mean, this is discussed in much greater depth, actually. I mentioned Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik. He has a classic article called Rupture and Reconstruction,
yeah.
in which he takes on this evolution and the shift from what he calls a mimetic culture, where you're doing things because this is what you saw growing up, to a text culture, where you're doing this because this is what it says in the book.
Yeah.
So much of that, by the way, of an example of that is there an actual place for why people walk down the chuppah in a coat, or is that because in Poland and Europe it was freezing, so they wore a coat? Because I think a lot of
the stuff that's written is a lot of it's from what they thought.
That's what they thought.
Sometimes,
that's what
yeah.
they grew up.
Sometimes,
they usually
yeah.
do write. Like there's a, it's a minhag. They state that if it's mm-hmm. done well.
Yeah. So I'm not answering the coat question.
No.
The I don't know. The but Rabbeinu Tam wrote on.
I've heard that.
Rabbeinu Tam wrote on everything. I don't have the sources here on the sheet, but I want to at least mention it. Rabbeinu Tam endorsed social coercion in order to induce a husband to give a get.
Oh, wow.
That's him. The idea that you exclude him, you don't do business with him and all of that, that's Rabbeinu.
Physically harm him?
So physical harm he does not go with. That's already, I mean, the Gemara talks yes. about that as a possibility. The it's this whole, like, ostracism that he has in Sefer HaYashar, and it makes it into Shulchan Aruch in the Bnei Rama, quoting him. Yeah, he wrote on the halachas of davening. He endorsed the use of piyutim in davening. The Sfaridim were very against. The Rambam was not a fan. Ibn Ezra was not a fan. Rabbeinu Tam was good.
Well, he wrote them probably.
So it. He probably did actually, but
I
he wasn't talking about his
own. The Sfaridim were way more flowery.
No, the Sfaridim were not into the way... The Sfaridim were poets. The Sfaridim were poets, but they didn't like the idea of putting them into the brachos of Shmona Esrei. If you think of Chazaras Hashatz...
That's the Sfarid, the flowerier one.
That's Sfarid, no, that's not Sfarid.
Right.
I know, but still
but,
it came
but
from
if you,
Sfarid influence.
In Chazaras Hashatz, when you think of the way it's done in Shul, where on Yamim Noraim, so they'll do misod chachamim unavonim and throw that into, you know, into there. Things like that in Ashkenaz are routine. I think we talked about this at one point. The Krovitzes, we talked about. This was something that was routine within the Brachas Hashemana Esrei. You just interrupt to start throwing in piyutim. That's an Ashkenaz thing. The Rambam did not like that idea at all. He wrote multiple responses criticizing that. Ibn Ezra made a lot of fun of it. He mocked the Hebrew of it. It was very interesting. But Rabbeinu Tam becomes known as an authority among both Ashkenazim and Sfardim. Hmm. In the year 1160, he holds a rabbinic convention of more than 250 rabbis in Troyes, creating all sorts of enactments for governing the French Jewish communities. The year 1196, the German communities convene, and they accept what Rabbeinu Tam had set up at that convention. It becomes part of what's called the Takanot Shum. Right? Takanot Takana. Shum is an acronym for Speyer, Vermeise, Magenza, the three major German communities. Speyer, Worms, and Mainz. Speyer, Vermeise, and Magenza. That's going to be on the final. You should make sure you write that down.
So the three German communities took on what Rabbeinu Tam said in French.
And then yes, and then they did more things. But yeah, it starts out with this influence from Rabbeinu Tam. He's very respected in Sfarad as well. The Sefer HaKabbalah, which I've quoted off and on, Rabbi Avraham Ibn Daud talks about him. He was very, very strong in responding to those who disagreed with him. There was a Rabbeinu Meshulam who made the mistake of writing him letters that challenged him on different things. And you read his responses, and he doesn't leave anything. Like, it's scorched earth. There's nothing left when he's done with Rabbeinu Meshulam. It's very sad. And students come to him from far away, including as far away as Russia. He has this massive, massive influence. There's a lot more we could say about Rabbeinu Tam, but that's just like a piece of his
First of all, he's the most dominant of the Tosfos.
I think so. That's a fair statement.
He's the one that made it like as important as Rashi, let's say, in the Gemara.
I mean, I wouldn't compare what he's doing with what Rashi is doing, because they're doing different things, right? Rashi is trying to explain a sugya, and to someone who wants to understand the sugya, that's where they're going to go. Rabbeinu Tam is giving you something with greater depth and greater halachic significance. It's only a thing if you actually are looking for that. If that's not
right,
what
but today, you're looking for. Today, you know, yeshivas place equal value. they place equal value on both.
It's an interesting question. I think I mentioned last week that there are those who like to say that it was a mistake that the publishers put Tosfos on the daf. You'd be better off if you had the Rush. The Rush is a Talmud of the Balei HaTosfos, like he's drawing on them, but he gives you a much clearer, you know, sort of guidance on halacha than that, right? If I want to learn halacha, I'm not starting from Tosfos. On the other hand, if I want to learn a Gemara and get a better understanding of it than just what I'm getting by a superficial read through, it's there on the daf, and that makes it a lot easier to get. And it'll give me more of a positioning of this sugya in the rest of Shas, because that's what they're drawing on. Yeah. Okay? Mm-hmm. All right. So, how are we doing on time? Do we have time to start on the ref? Yeah, I think so. I can't tell.